and then set it down on a small table on the other side of the door. She turned back to Dahl. "Is this some kind of a joke?" she said. "No joke," Dahl said. "I'm not trying to trick you or sell you anything. After today, you won't see me again. All I'm doing is delivering this to you." "I don't understand," Martinez said again. "I don't understand how you have all these pictures of me with someone I don't even know." "They're not my pictures. They're his," Dahl said, and held out the box the projector came in to Martinez. "Here, there's a note in the box from him. It'll explain things better than I can, I think." Martinez took the box and took out a folded sheet, dense with writing. "This is from him," she said. "Yes," Dahl said. "Why isn't he here?" Martinez asked. "Why didn't he deliver it himself?" "It's complicated," Dahl repeated. "But even if he could have been, I think he would have been afraid to. And I think seeing you might have broken his heart." "Because of her," Martinez said. "Yes," Dahl said. "Does he want to meet me?" Martinez asked. "Is this his way of introducing himself?" "I think it's his way of introducing himself, yes," Dahl said. "But I'm afraid he can't meet you." "Why?" Martinez asked. "He has to be somewhere else," Dahl said. "That's the easiest way to put it. Maybe his letter will explain it better." "I'm sorry I keep saying this, but I still don't understand," Martinez said. "You show up at my door with pictures of someone who looks just like me, who you say is the person I played for a minute in a television show, who is dead and who has a husband who sends me gifts. You know how crazy that sounds?" "I do," Dahl said. "Why would he do this?" Martinez said. "What's the point of it?" "Are you asking my opinion?" Dahl asked. "I am," Martinez said. "Because he misses his wife," Dahl said. "He misses his wife so much that it's turned his life inside out. In a way that's hard to explain, you being here and being alive means that in some way his wife's life continues. So he's sending her to you. He wants to give you the part of her life he had with her." "But why?" Martinez said. "Because it's his way of letting her go," Dahl said. "He's giving her to you so he can get on with the rest of his life." "He said this to you," Martinez said. "No," Dahl said, "but I think that's why he did it." Martinez stepped away from the door quickly. When she came back a minute later, she had a tissue in her hand, with which she had dried her eyes. She looked up at Dahl and smiled weakly. "This is definitely the strangest Saturday morning I've had in a while," she said. "Sorry about that," Dahl said. "No, it's fine," Martinez said. "I still don't understand, but I guess I'm helping your friend, aren't I?" "I think you are," Dahl said. "Thank you for that." "I'm sorry," Martinez said and stepped aside slightly. "Would you like to come in for a minute?" "I would love to, but I can't," Dahl said. "I have a taxi running its meter, and I have people waiting for me." "Going back to your mysterious, complicated place," Martinez said. "Yes," Dahl said. "Which reminds me, that projector and that letter will probably disappear in a couple of days." "Like, vaporize?" Martinez said. "As in, this letter will self-destruct in 5 seconds?" "Pretty much," Dahl said. "Are you a spy or something?" Martinez said, smiling. "It's complicated," Dahl said once more. "In any event, I suggest making copies of everything. You can probably just project the pictures against a white wall and take pictures of them and scan the letter." "I'll do that," Martinez said. "Thanks for telling me." "You're welcome," Dahl said, and turned to go. "Wait a second," Martinez said. "Your friend. Are you going to see him when you get back?" "Yes," Dahl said. Martinez stepped out of the doorway to Dahl and gave him a small kiss on the cheek. "Give him that for me," she said. "And tell him that I said thank you, and that I'll take good care of Margaret for him." "I will," Dahl said. "I promise." "Thank you." She leaned up and gave him a peck on the other cheek. "That's for you." Dahl smiled. "Thanks." Martinez grinned and went back into the bungalow. "So, you ready for this?" Dahl asked Hester in the shuttle. "Of course not," Hester said. "If everything goes according to plan, then the moment you guys go back to our universe, I'll be transported from this perfectly functioning body to one that has severe physical and brain damage, at which point all I can hope for is that we're not wrong about 25th century medicine being able to cure me. If everything doesn't go according to plan, then in 48 hours all my atoms go pop. I want to ask you how you think one gets ready for either scenario. Good point, Dahl said. I want to know how you talked me into this, Hester said. I'm apparently very persuasive, Dahl said. Then again, I'm the guy who got talked into holding Finn's drugs for him because he convinced me they were candy, Hester said. If I recall correctly, they were candied, Dahl said. I'm gullible and weak-willed is what I'm saying, Hester said. I disagree with that assessment, Dahl said. Well, you would say that, Hester said, now that you've talked me into your ridiculous plan. The two of them stood over the body of Matthew Paulson, whose stretcher was surrounded by mobile life support apparatus. Duval was checking the equipment and the comatose body it was attached to. How is he? Dahl asked. He's stable, Duval said. The machines are doing the hard work for the moment, and the shuttle has adapters I could use, so long as we don't have to worry about depleting any batteries. As long as he doesn't have any major medical emergencies between now and when we make the transition back, we should be fine. And if he does? Hester asked. Duval looked at him. Then I'll do my best with the training I have, she said. She reached over and slapped his shoulder. Don't worry, I'm not going to let you down. Guys, it's time to go, Kerensky said from the pilot seat of the shuttle. Our trip over from Griffith Park did not go unnoticed, and I've got at least 3 aircraft coming our way. We've got another couple of minutes before things get messy. Got it, Dahl said, and looked back to Hester. So you're ready for this, he said. Yes, Hester said. The two of them walked outside into the lawn of Charles Poulsen's Malibu estate. Charles and his family were there, waiting for Hester. Hansen, who had been keeping them company, broke off and joined Dahl. Hester walked over to join Paulson's family. When will we know? Paulson asked Dahl. We're taking the engines to maximum capacity to the black hole we're using, Dahl said. It'll be within the day. I suppose you'll know when your son starts acting like your son again. If it works, Paulson said. If it works, Dahl agreed. Let's work on the assumption it will. Yes, let's, Hester said. Now, Dahl said to Paulson, we're agreed on everything. Yes, Paulson said. None of your characters will be killed off going forward. The show will stop randomly killing off extras, and the show itself will wrap up next season, and we won't make any new shows in the universe within 100 years of your timeline. And this episode, Dahl said, the one where everything we planned happens? Nick messaged me about it a few minutes ago, Paulson said. He said he's almost got a rough version done. As soon as it's done, he and I will work on a polish, and then we'll get it into production as soon as... Well, as soon as we know whether or not your plan worked. It'll work, Dahl said. It's going to make hell with our production schedule, Paulson said. I'm going to end up having to pay for this episode out of my own pocket. It'll be worth it, Dahl said. I know, Paulson said. If everything works, it'll be a hell of a show for you. Of course, Dahl said. Hester rolled his eyes a little. I hear helicopters, Hansen said. From the shuttle came the sound of engines primed to move. Dahl looked at Hester. Good luck, Hester said. See you soon, Dahl said, and made his way to the shuttle. They were gone before the helicopters could get to them. It's time, Kerensky said as they approached the black hole. Everyone get ready for the transition. Dahl, come take the co-pilot seat. I can't fly a shuttle, Dahl said. I don't need you to fly it, Kerensky said. I need you to hit the automatic homing and landing sequence in case that asshole rider has something explode and knock me out. Dahl got up and looked over to Duval. Hester doing okay, he asked. He's fine. Everything's fine, Duval said. He's not Hester yet, though. Call him Hester anyway, Dahl said. Maybe it'll matter. You're the boss, Duval said. Dahl sat down in the co-pilot seat. You remember how to do this, he said to Kerensky. Aim for the gap between the accretion disk and the Schwarzschild radius and boost engines to 110%, Kerensky said testily. I've got it. Although it might have been helpful for me to observe the last time we did it, but no, you had me in a crate without my pants. Sorry about that, Dahl said. Not that it matters anyway, Kerensky said. I'm your good luck charm, remember? We'll make it through this part just fine. Hopefully the rest of it too, Dahl said. If this plan of yours works, Kerensky said, how will we know that it's worked? When we revive Hester, and he's Hester, Dahl said. A sensor beeped. Transition in 10 seconds, Kerensky said. So we won't know until we're back on the Intrepid. Probably, Dahl said. Probably? Kerensky said. I thought of one way we might know if the transfer didn't take, Dahl said. How? Kerensky asked. The shuttle jammed itself into the ragged edge between the accretion disk and the Schwarzschild radius and transitioned instantly. In the view screen, the planet Forshan loomed large, and above it, a 12 ships, including the Intrepid, were locked in battle. Every single sensor on the shuttle flashed to red and began to blare. One of the nearby starships sparkled, sending a clutch of missiles toward the shuttle. "When we come through, it might look like this," Dahl said. Kerensky screamed, and Dahl then felt ill as Kerensky plunged the shuttle into evasive maneuvers. Chapter 22. 5 missiles coming," Dahl said, fighting the sickness in his stomach from the shuttle's dive to read the co-pilot's panel. "I know," Kerensky said. "Engines minimal," Dahl said. "We burn them coming through." "I know," Kerensky said. "Defense options?" Dahl asked. "It's a shuttle," Kerensky said. "I'm doing them." He corkscrewed the shuttle violently. The missiles changed course to follow, spreading out from their original configuration. A message popped up on Dahl's screen. 3 missiles locked," he said. "Impact in 6 seconds." Kerensky looked up, as if toward the heavens. "God damn it! I'm a featured character! Do something!" A beam of light lanced from the Intrepid, vaporizing the nearest missile. Kerensky yanked the shuttle over to avoid the explosion and debris. The Intrepid's pulse beam touched the 4 other missiles, turning them into atoms. "Holy shit, that worked!" Kerensky said. "If only you knew before, right?" Dahl said, amazed himself. The shuttle's phone activated. "Kerensky, come in," it said. It was Abernathy on the other end. "Kerensky here," he said. "Not a lot of time here," Abernathy said. "Do you have the carrier?" The carrier, Dahl thought, and then remembered that Hester carried in his body invasive cells whose DNA was a coded message detailing the final will and testament of the leader of the Forshan's rightward schism, which, if unlocked, could end the religious wars on Forshan, which would not be convenient to any number of leaders on either side of the conflict. Which was why all those ships were out there, to bring the shuttle down. Then Dahl remembered that until that very second, absolutely none of that was true. But it was now. "We have the carrier," Kerensky said. "Crewman Hester, yes, but he's awfully sick, Captain. We're barely keeping him alive." A panel on Dahl's co-pilot screen flashed. 3 new missiles away," he said to Kerensky, who spun the shuttle into new evasive maneuvers. "Kerensky, this is Chief Medical Officer Hartnell," a new voice said. "Crewman Hester's immune system is fighting those cells and losing. If you don't get him to the ship now, they're going to kill him, and then the cells will die too." "We're being fired on," Kerensky said. "It makes travel difficult." A new pulse beam flickered out of the Intrepid, vaporizing the 3 new missiles. "You worry about getting to the Intrepid, Kerensky," Abernathy said. "We'll worry about the missiles. Abernathy out." "The carrier?" Duval said from the back of the shuttle. "He's got cells in his body with an encoded message in his DNA? That doesn't even make sense." "Nick Weinstein had to write the episode really quick," Dahl said. "Cut him a break." "He also wrote this," Kerensky said, motioning out the view screens to the space battle in front of them. "If I ever see him again, I am going to kick his ass." "Focus," Dahl said. "We need to get to the Intrepid without dying." "Do you think Paulson's son is in Hester's old body?" Kerensky said. "What?" Dahl said. "Do you think the switch worked?" Kerensky asked, glancing at Dahl. Dahl looked back at the body on the stretcher. "I don't know," he said. "Maybe?" "Maybe works for me," Kerensky said. Stopped the shuttle's evasive maneuvers and jammed it as fast as it would go, straight toward the Intrepid. All around them, Forshan spacecraft fired missiles, beams, and projectiles. The Intrepid lit up like a Christmas tree, firing all available weapons to shoot down missiles and disable beams and projectile weapons on the Forshan spacecraft. "This is a bad idea," Dahl said to Kerensky, who was grimly staring forward, keeping the Intrepid squarely in his sights. "We're going to live or die," Kerensky said. "Why fuck around?" "I liked you better before you were a fatalist," Dahl said. A missile erupted starboard, knocking the shuttle off its course. The shuttle's inertial dampeners flickered, hurling Hester, Duval, and Hansen around the rear of the shuttle. "Don't fly into missiles!" Duval shouted. "Blame the rider!" Kerensky shot back. "That's a shitty excuse!" Duval said. The shuttle rocked again as another missile scored a near miss. The shuttle ran through the gauntlet of ships, breaking through toward the Intrepid. "The shuttle bay is aft," Dahl said. "We're not aimed at aft." "Here's where we find out just how hot a shuttle pilot that rider thinks I am," Kerensky said, and threw the shuttle into a reverse Fibonacci spiral over the top of the Intrepid. Dahl groaned as the Intrepid wheeled and grew in the view screen. Missiles vibrated the shuttle as they zoomed by, narrowly missing the arcing shuttle. Dahl was certain they were going to smash against the Intrepid's hull, and then they were in the shuttle bay, slamming into the deck. The shuttle screeched violently, and something fell off of it outside. Kerensky whooped and shut down the engines. "That's good television," he said. "I'm never flying with you again," Duval said from the back of the shuttle. "There's no time to waste," Kerensky said, changing his demeanor so suddenly that Dahl had no doubt he'd just been gripped by the narrative. "We've got to get Hester to sickbay. Dahl, you're with me on the left side of the stretcher. Duval, Hansen, take the right. Let's run, people." Dahl unbuckled and scrambled over to the stretcher, unexpectedly giddy. Kerensky had used Hester's name while under the influence of the narrative. As they raced through the corridors with the stretcher, they heard the booms and thumps of the Intrepid under attack. "Now that we're on board, all those ships are attacking the Intrepid," Kerensky said. "We need to hurry." The ship shook again, more severely. "Took you long enough," Medical Officer Hartnell said as the four of them wheeled the stretcher into sickbay. "Any longer and there wouldn't be a sickbay left, or any other part of the ship." "Can't we bug out?" Dahl heard himself say as they maneuvered the stretcher. "Engines have been disabled in the attack," Hartnell said. "Nowhere to run. If we don't get this message out of him fast, we're all dead. Lift!" They lifted Hester's body and put it onto a medical table. Hartnell flicked at his tablet, and Hester's body stiffened. "There, he's in stasis," Hartnell said. "He'll be stable until all of this is done." He looked down at his medical tablet and frowned. "What the hell are all these fractures and brain trauma?" he said. "It was a rough shuttle ride," Kerensky said. Hartnell looked at Kerensky as if he were going to say something, but then the entire ship lurched, throwing everyone but Hester to the deck. "Oh, that's not good," Duval said. Hartnell's phone activated. "This is the captain," Abernathy said through the phone. "What's the status of the carrier?" "Crewman Hester's alive and in stasis," Hartnell said. "I'm about to take a sample of the invasive cells to start the decoding process." There was another violent shudder to the ship. "You're going to need to work faster than that," Abernathy said. "We're taking hits we can't keep taking. We need that decoded now." "Now isn't going to work," Hartnell said. "How much time can you give me?" Another shudder, and the lights flickered. "I can give you 10 minutes, Abernathy said. "Try not to use them all." The captain disconnected. Hartnell looked at them all. "We're fucked," he said. Dahl couldn't help smiling crazily at that. Pretty sure he wasn't in the narrative when he said that, he thought. "Andy," Hansen said, "the box." "Shit," Dahl said, "the box." "What's a box?" Hartnell said. "Take a sample and give it to me," Dahl said to Hartnell. "Why?" Hartnell asked. "I'll take it to xenobiology and run it there," Dahl said. "We've got the same equipment here," Hartnell said. Dahl looked over to Kerensky for help. "Just do it, Hartnell," Kerensky said, "before you get us all killed." Hartnell frowned, but took his sampler and jammed it into Hester's arm, then took out the sample container and gave it to Dahl. "Here. Now someone please tell me what this is about." "Andy," Hansen said, "to get to xenobiology from here, you'll need to go through deck 6. "Right," Dahl said, and turned to Kerensky. "Come with me, please." "Who's going to tell me what's going on?" Hartnell said. And then Dahl and Kerensky were out the door into the corridor. "What's with deck 6? Kerensky asked as they ran. "It has a tendency to blow up when we're attacked," Dahl said. "Like right now." "You're using me as a good luck charm again, aren't you?" Kerensky said. "Not exactly," Dahl said. Deck 6 was exploding and on fire. "The corridors are blocked," Kerensky said over the noise. "Come on," Dahl said, and slapped open an access door to the cargo tunnels. There was a gust as the heated air of Deck 6 blew into the open door. Kerensky went through, and Dahl shut the access door as something erupted in the hall. "This way," Dahl said, and the two fished their way around the cargo carts to an access door on the other side of the deck, and then back into the main corridors. Lieutenant Collins did not look happy to see Dahl. "What are you doing here?" she said. Dahl ignored her and went to the storage room, pulling out the box. "Hey, you can't be using that around Kerensky," Collins said, moving toward Dahl. "If she tries to come near me, take her out," Dahl said to Kerensky. "Got it," Kerensky said. Collins abruptly stopped. "Take her tablet," Dahl said. Kerensky did. "How much time?" Dahl asked. He set the box on an induction pad. 7 minutes, Kerensky said. "That'll work," Dahl said, slipped the sample into the box, and pressed the green button. He walked over to Kerensky, took Collins' tablet, signed her off, and signed into his own account. "Now what?" Kerensky said. "We wait," Dahl said. "For how long?" Kerensky said. As long as dramatically appropriate, Dahl said. Kerensky peered at the box. So, this was the thing that kept me from turning into mush when I got the Morovian plague. That's it, Dahl said. Ridiculous, Kerensky said. Collins looked at Kerensky, gaping. You know? She said. You're not supposed to know. At this point, I know a lot more than you, Kerensky said. The box pinged, and the tablet was flooded with data. Dahl barely glanced at it. We're good, he said. Back to sickbay. They ran out of xenobiology, back to the access corridors, to get back to Deck 6. Almost there, Kerensky said, as they emerged out of the access corridors into the fires of Deck 6. The ship rocked violently, and the main corridor of Deck 6 collapsed onto Dahl, crushing him and slicing a jagged shard of metal through his liver. Dahl stared at it for a moment and then looked at Kerensky. You had to say almost there, he whispered, the words dribbling out between drifts of blood. Oh, God, Dahl, Kerensky said, and started trying to move debris off of him. Stop, Dahl said. Kerensky ignored him. Stop, he said, again, more forcefully. Kerensky stopped. Dahl pushed the tablet, still in his hands, to Kerensky. No time. Take the results. Feed them into the sickbay computer. Don't let Hartnell argue. When the sickbay computer has the data, the narrative will take over. It will be done. But get there. Hurry. Dahl, Kerensky said, this is why I brought you with me, Dahl said, because I knew whatever happened to me, you'd make it back. Now go. Save the day, Kerensky. Save the day. Kerensky nodded, took the tablet, and ran. Dahl lay there, pinned through the liver, and in his final moments of consciousness, tried to focus on the fact that Hester would live, the ship would be saved, and his friends would make it through the rest of their lives without being savaged by the narrative. And all it needed was one more dramatic death of an extra. His dramatic death. It's a fair trade, he thought, trying to reconcile himself to how it all played out. A fair trade. Saved his friends. Saved Matthew Paulson. Saved the Intrepid. A fair trade. But as everything went gray and slid into black, a final thought bubbled up from the bottom of what was left of him. Screw this. I want to live, it said. But then, everything went to black anyway. Stop being dramatic, a voice said. We know you're awake. Dahl opened his eyes. Hester was standing over him, along with Duval and Hansen. Dahl smiled at Hester. It worked, he said. It's you. It really worked. Of course it worked, Hester said. Why wouldn't it work? Dahl laughed weakly at this. He tried to get up, but couldn't. Stasis medical chair, Duval said. You're regrowing a liver and a lot of burned skin and healing a broken rib cage. You wouldn't like what you'd be feeling if you moved. How long have I been in this thing? Dahl asked. 4 days, Hansen said. You were a mess. I thought I was dead. You would have been dead if someone hadn't rescued you, Duval said. Who rescued me? Dahl asked. Another face loomed into view. Jenkins, Dahl said. You were right outside a cargo tunnel, Jenkins said. I figured, might as well. Thank you, Dahl said. No thanks necessary, Jenkins said. I did it purely out of self-interest. If you died, I would never know if you ever delivered that message for me. I did, Dahl said. How did it go over? Jenkins asked. It went over well, Dahl said. I'm supposed to give you a kiss for her. Well, maybe some other time, Jenkins said. What are you two talking about? Duval asked. I'll tell you later, Dahl said, and then looked back to Jenkins. So, you're out of your hiding place then? Yes, he said. It was time. Good, Dahl said. And the great news is, we're all heroes, Hester said. The message was extracted out of my body and broadcast by the Intrepid, ending the religious war on Forshan. How lucky is that? Amazing, Dahl said. Of course, none of it even begins to make sense, if you think about it, Hester said. It never has, Dahl said. Later in the day, after his friends had left, Dahl had another visitor. Science Officer King, Dahl said. Ensign, King said. You are healing? So I've been told, Dahl said. Lieutenant Kerensky tells me it was you who cracked the code, so the rightward schism leader's last will and testament could be broadcast, King said. I suppose it was, Dahl said, although I can't honestly take all the credit. Nevertheless, for your bravery and sacrifice, I have written you up for a commendation, King said. If it's approved, which it will be, then you will also be advanced in rank. So, let me be the first to say, congratulations, Lieutenant. Thank you, sir, Dahl said. There's one other thing, King said. Just a few minutes ago, I received a highly classified message from the Universal Union High Command. I was informed that I was to read it to you, and only to you, out loud. All right, sir, Dahl said. I'm ready. King pulled out his phone, pressed the screen, and read the words there. Andy, I don't know if these words will reach you. Nick wrote this scene, and we filmed it, but obviously it won't be shown on TV. I don't know if just filming it will be enough, and I guess there is no way for you to tell us if it worked. But if it does, I want you to know two things. One, I'm sorry for everything you just got put through. Nick felt we had to really push the action in this one, or the audience would start to question what was going on. Maybe that's not a great argument to you now, considering where you are, but it made sense at the time. Two, no words I can say will ever thank you, Jasper, and all of you for what you have done for my family and for me. You gave me my son back, and by giving him back, you have given us everything. We will stick to our end of the agreement. Everything we said we would do, we will. I don't know what else to say except this. Thank you for letting us live happily ever after. We will do the same for you. In love and gratitude, Charles Paulson. Thank you, Dahl said to King after a moment. You are welcome, King said, putting away his phone. A most curious message. I suppose you could say it's in code, sir, Dahl said. Are you allowed to tell your superior officer what it's about? King asked. It's a message from God, Dahl said. Or someone close enough to him for our purposes. King looked at Dahl appraisingly. I sometimes get the feeling there are things happening on the Intrepid that I'm not meant to know about, he said. I suspect this is one of them. Sir, and with all due respect, Dahl said, you don't know how right you are. Chapter 23. So what now? Duval asked. The four of them were in the mess, picking at their midday meal. What do you mean? Hester asked. I mean, what now? Duval said. She pointed to Hester. You're transplanted into a new body. Her point changed to Dahl. He's back from the dead. We've all come back from an alternate reality to keep ourselves from being killed for dramatic purposes. We've won. What now? I don't think it works like that, Hansen said. I don't think we've won anything, other than being in control of our own lives. Right, Hester said. After everything, what it all means is that if one day we slip in the bathroom and crack our head on the toilet, our last thoughts can be a satisfied, well, I and only I did this to myself. When you put it that way, it hardly seems worth it, Duval said. I don't mind cracking my head on the toilet, Hester said, as long as I do it at age 120. On your 120th birthday, I'll come over with floor wax, Duval promised. I can't wait, Hester said. Andy? You okay? Hansen asked. I'm fine, Dahl said and smiled. Sorry, was just thinking. About being fictional and all that. We're over that now, Hester said. That was the point of all of this. You're right, Dahl said, I know. Duval looked at her phone. Crap, I'm going to be late, she said. I'm breaking in a new crew member. Oh, the burdens of a promotion, Hester said. It's hard, it really is, Duval said, and got up. I'll walk with you, Hester said. You can tell me more of your woes. Excellent, Duval said. The two of them left. Hansen looked back at Dahl. Still thinking about being fictional, he said after a minute. Sort of, Dahl said. What I've been really thinking about is you, Jimmy. Me, Hansen said. Yeah, Dahl said. Because while I was recuperating from our last adventure, something struck me about you. You don't really fit. That's interesting, Hansen said. Tell me why. Think about it, Dahl said. Think of the five of us who met that first day, the day we joined the crew of the Intrepid. Each of us turned out to be critical in some way. Hester, who didn't seem to have a purpose, turned out to be the key to everything. Duval had medical training and got close to Kerensky, which helped us when we needed it, and made him part of our crew when we needed him. Finn gave us tools and information we needed, and his loss galvanized us to take action. Jenkins gave us context for our situation and the means to do something about it. What about you? Hansen asked. Where do you fit in? Well, that's the one I had a hard time with, Dahl said. I wondered what I brought to the party. I thought maybe I was just the man with the plan, the guy who came up with the basic ideas everyone else went along with, logistics. But then I started thinking about Kerensky and what he is to the show. He's the guy who gets beat up to show that the main characters can get beat up, Hansen said. Right, Dahl said. But you can't be Kerensky, Hansen said. We have a Kerensky. It's Kerensky. It's not about Kerensky getting beat up, Dahl said. It's about Kerensky not dying. I'm not following you, Hansen said. Jimmy, how many times should I have died since we've been on the Intrepid? Dahl asked. I count at least three. The first time when I was attacked at Eskridge Colony when Castlewayne and Bakey died. Then in the Nance interrogation room with Finn and Captain Abernathy. And then on Deck 6 when we returned to the Intrepid with Hester. Three times I should have been dead. No ifs, ands, or buts. I should be dead three times over. But I'm not. I get hurt. I get hurt really badly. But I don't die. That's when I figured it out. I'm the protagonist. But you're an extra, Hansen said. We all are. Jenkins said it. Charles Paulson said it. Even the actor playing you said it. I'm an extra on the show, Dahl said. I'm the protagonist somewhere else. Where? Hansen said. That's what I want you to tell me, Jimmy, Dahl said. What? Hansen said. What are you talking about? It's like I said. You don't fit, Dahl said. Everyone else served a strong purpose for the story. Everyone but you. For this, you were just around, Jimmy. You have a backstory, but it never really entered into what we did. You did a few useful things. You looked into show trivia and talked about people, and occasionally you reminded people to do things. You added just enough that it seemed like you were taking part. But the more I think about it, the more I realize that you don't quite add up the way the rest of us do. Life is like that, Andy, Hansen said. It's messy. We don't all add up that way. No, Dahl said. We do. Everyone else does. Everyone else but you. The only way you fit is if the thing you're supposed to do, you haven't done yet. The only way you fit is if there's something else going on here. We're all supposed to think we were real people who found out they were extras on a television show, but I know that doesn't begin to explain me. I should be dead several times over, like Kerensky or any of the show's major characters are supposed to be dead, but aren't, because the universe plays favorites with them. The universe plays favorites with me, too. Maybe you're lucky, Hansen said. No one is that lucky, Jimmy, Dahl said. So here's what I think. I think there's no television show. No real television show. I think that Charles Paulson and Mark Corey and Brian Abnett and everyone else over there are just as fictional as we were supposed to be. I think Captain Abernathy and Commander King, Medical Officer Hartnell and Chief Engineer West are the bit players here. And that me, Maya, and Finn and Jasper are the people who really count. And I think, in the end, you really exist for just one reason. What reason is that, Andy? Hansen said. To tell me that I'm right about this, Dahl said. My parents would be surprised by your conclusion, Hansen said. My parents would be surprised by all of this, Dahl said. Our parents are not the point here. Andy, we've known each other for years, Hansen said. I think you know who I am. Jimmy, Dahl said, please, tell me if I'm right. Hansen sat there for a minute, looking at Dahl. I don't think it would actually make you happier to be told you were right about this, he said, finally. I don't want to be happy, Dahl said. I just want to know. And even if you were right, Hansen said, what do you get out of it? Aren't you better off believing that you've accomplished something? That you've gotten the happy ending you were promised? Why would you want to push that? Because I need to know, Dahl said. I've always needed to know. Because that's the way you are, Hansen said. A seeker of truth. A spiritual man. Yes, Dahl said. A man who needs to know if he's really that way, or just written to be that way, Hansen said. Yes, Dahl said. Someone who needs to know if he's really his own man, or... Tell me you're not about to make the pun I think you are, Dahl said. Hansen smiled. Sorry, he said. It was there. He pushed out from his chair and stood up. Andy, you're my friend. Do you believe that? Yes, Dahl said. I do. Then maybe you can believe this, Hansen said. Whether you're an extra or the hero, this story is about to end. When it's done, whatever you want to be will be up to you and only you. It will happen away from the eyes of any audience and from the hand of any writer. You will be your own man. If I exist when I stop being written, Dahl said. There is that, Hansen said. It's an interesting philosophical question, but if I had to guess, I'd guess that your creator would say to you that he would want you to live happily ever after. That's just a guess, Dahl said. Maybe a little more than a guess, Hansen said. But I will say this, though. You were right. About what? Dahl said. That now I've done what I was supposed to do, Hansen said. But now I have to go do the other thing I'm supposed to do, which is assume my post. See you at dinner, Andy. Dahl grinned. Yes, he said, if any of us are around for it. Great, Hansen said. See you then. And he wandered off. Dahl sat there for a few more minutes, thinking about everything that had happened and everything that Hansen said. And then he got up and went to his station on the bridge, because whether fictional or not, on a spaceship, a television show, or in something else entirely, he still had work to do, surrounded by his friends and the crew of the Intrepid. And that's just what he did, until the day, 6 months later, when a systems failure caused the Intrepid to plow into a small asteroid, vaporizing the ship and killing everyone on board instantly. Chapter 24. No, I'm just fucking with you. They all lived happily ever after. Seriously. Coda 1. First person. Hello, Internet. There isn't any good way to start this, so let me just jump right in. So, I am a scriptwriter for a television show on a major network who just found out that the people he's been making up in his head and killing off at the rate of about one an episode are actually real. Now I have writer's block. I don't know how to solve it. And if I don't figure it out soon, I'm going to get fired. Help me. And now I just spent 20 minutes looking at that last paragraph and feeling like an asshole. Let me break it down further to explain it to you a little better. Hello, Internet. You know that New Yorker cartoon that has a dog talking to another dog by a computer and saying, on the Internet, no one knows you're a dog? Yeah, well, this is that. No, I'm not a dog. But yes, I need some anonymity here. Because holy shit, look what I just wrote up there. That's not something you can just say out loud to people. But on the Internet, anonymously, might fly. I am a scriptwriter. I really am. I've been working for several years on the show, which, duh, has been successful enough to have been around for several years. I don't want to go into too much more detail about that right now, because remember, I'm trying to have some anonymity here to work through this thing I've been dealing with. Suffice to say that it's not going to win any major Emmys, but it's still the sort of show that you, my dear Internet, would probably watch. And that in the real world, I have an IMDb page, and it's pretty long, so there. Who just found out the people he's been making up in his head are real. Yes, I know. Didn't I just say holy shit 2 paragraphs ago about it? Don't you think I know how wobbly-toothed speed freak crazy it sounds? I do. I very, 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 very much do. If I didn't think it was completely bug-fuck crazy, I'd be writing about it on my own actual blog. If I had my own actual blog, which I don't because I work on a weekly television series, and who has the time? And finding some way to go full Whitley Strieber on it. I don't want that. That's a lifestyle. A whacked out late night talking to the tinfoil hatted on your podcast lifestyle. I don't want that. I just want to be able to get back to my own writing. But still, the people I wrote in my scripts exist. I know because I met them, swear to God, right there in the flesh. I could reach out and touch them. And whenever I kill one of them off in my scripts, they actually die. To me, it's just putting down words on a page. To them, it's falling off a building or being hit by a car or being eaten by a bear or whatever. These are just examples. They're not necessarily how I've killed people off. Think about that. Think about what it means. That just writing down Bob is consumed by badgers in a script means that somewhere in the universe, some poor bastard named Bob has just been chased down by ravenous mustelids. Sure, it sounds funny when I write it like that, but if you were Bob, it would suck. And then you would be dead thanks to me. Which explains the next part. Now I have writer's block. You know, I never understood writer's block before this. You're a writer, and you suddenly can't write because your girlfriend broke up with you? Shit, dude, that's the perfect time to write. It's not like you're doing anything else with your nights. Having a hard time coming up with the next scene? Have something explode. You're done. Filled with existential ennui about your place in the universe? Get over yourself. Yes, you're an inconsequential worm in the grand scope of history. But you're an inconsequential worm who makes shit up for a living, which means that you don't have to lift heavy boxes or ask people if they want fries with that. Grow up and get back to work. On a good day, I can bang out a first draft of an episode in 6 hours. Is it good? It ain't Shakespeare. But then Shakespeare wrote Titus Andronicus, so you tell me. 6 hours, one script, a good day. And I have to tell you, as a writer, I've had my share of good days. But now I have writer's block, and I can't write a script because, fuck me, I kill people when I write. It's a pretty good excuse for having writer's block, if you ask me. Girlfriend leaving you? Get on with it. You send people to their deaths by typing? Might give you pause. It's given me pause. Now, I sit in front of my laptop, final draft all loaded up, and just stare at the screen for hours. I'm going to get fired. My job is writing scripts. I'm not writing scripts. If I don't start writing scripts again, soon, there's no reason for me to be kept on staff. I've been able to stall a bit because I had one script in the outbox before the block slammed down, but that gives me about a week's insurance. That's not a lot of time. You see why I'm nervous. Help me. Look, I need help. This isn't something I can talk to with people I actually know, because, again, bug shit crazy. I can't afford to have people I work with, or other writers I know, most of whom are unemployed and would be happy to crawl over my carcass to get my television show writing staff position, think that I've lost my marbles. Gigs like this don't grow on trees. But I have to talk to someone about it. Because, for the life of me, I haven't the first damn clue about what I should be doing about this. I need some perspective from outside my own head. And this is where you come in, Internet. You have perspective. And I'm guessing that some of you might just be bored enough to help out some anonymous dude on the Internet asking for advice on a completely ridiculous situation. It's either this or Angry Birds, right? So, what do you say, Internet? Yours, Anana Writer. So, the good news is that apparently people are reading this. The bad news is people are asking me questions instead of, you know, helping me. But then again, when you anonymously post on the internet that the characters you write have suddenly come alive, I suppose you have to answer a few questions first. Fine. So, for those of you who need it, a quick run-through of the most common questions I've gotten so far. I'm going to paraphrase some to keep from repeating questions and comments. Dude, are you serious? Dude, I am serious. I am not high. Being high is more fun. I am not making this up. If I was making things up, I would be getting paid for it. And I am not crazy. Crazy would be more fun, too. This is for real. Really? Yes. Really? Yes. No. Really? Shut up. Next question. Why haven't you discussed this with your therapist? Because contrary to popular belief, not every writer in Los Angeles has been in therapy since before they could walk. All my neuroses are manageable. Or were, anyway. I suppose I could get one, but that would be a hell of a first session, wouldn't it? And I'm not entirely convinced I'd get out of there without being sedated and sent off to the funny farm. Call me paranoid. Isn't this kind of the plot to that movie Stranger Than Fiction? Maybe? That's the Will Ferrell movie where he's a character in someone's book, right? I know, I could check this on IMDb, but I'm lazy. Except for that I'm the writer, not the character. So, same concept, different spin. Maybe? But look, even if it is, I didn't say what was happening to me was creatively 100% original. I mean, there's the Purple Rose of Cairo, which had characters coming down off the screen. There's those Jasper Ford books where everyone's a fairy tale or literary character. There's Denise Hogan's books where she's always arguing with her characters and sometimes they don't listen to her and mess with her plots. My mom loves those. Hell, there's The Last Action Hero, for God's sake. Have you seen that? You have. I'm sorry. There's also the small but telling detail that those are all fictional and this is really happening to me. Like I said, a subtle difference. But an important one. I'm not going for originality here. I'm trying to get this solved. Hey, is your show, insert name of show here? Friend, what part of I want to be anonymous, don't you understand? Even if you guessed right, I'm still not going to tell you. Want a hint? Fine, it's not 30 Rock. Also, I am not Tina Fey. Tina Fey. Likewise. You know that these days the internet does know if you're a dog, right? Yes, but this dog opened this blog account using a throwaway email address and cruises the web using Tor. Why don't you just write scripts where people don't get killed? Well, I could do that, but two things will happen then. Number one, the script gets turned in and the producers say, "The stakes need to be raised in this scene. Kill someone." And then I have to kill someone in the script, or a co-writer does, or one of the producers does a quick uncredited wash of the script, or the director zaps a character during shooting and someone dies anyway. Number two, even if I don't kill anyone, there still needs to be drama. And on a show like mine, drama usually means if someone isn't killed, then they are maimed or mutilated or given a disease that turns them into a pustule with legs. Admittedly, turning a character into a pustule is better than killing them dead, but it's still not comfortable for them, and it's still me doing it to them. So I still have guilt. Believe me, there's nothing I'd like to do better than turn in scripts where the characters do nothing but lounge on pillows, eating chocolates, and having hot, cathartic sex for an hour. Minus commercial time, your capitalistically inspired refractory period. I think our audience wouldn't mind either. It would be inspirational and educational. But it's not that kind of show. And there's only so edgy basic cable is going to let us be. I have to write stuff that's actually like what gets written for our show, basically. If I don't, I'll get canned. I don't want to get canned. You understand that if what you're saying is actually true, then the existential ramifications are astounding. Yeah, it's pretty weird shit. I could go on for hours about it. That is, if it wasn't also messing with my day-to-day life in a pretty substantial way. You know what it's like? It's like waking up one morning, going outside, and finding a Tyrannosaurus Rex in your front yard staring at you. For the first 5 seconds, you're completely amazed that a real live dinosaur is standing in front of you. And then you run like hell, because to a T-Rex, you're a chewy, crunchy, bite-sized snack. Is there a T-Rex in your front yard? No. Damn. You're not helping. For someone who says they're having writing block, aren't you writing a lot? Yeah, but this isn't real writing, is it? I'm not doing anything creative here. I'm just answering comments and asking for help. Blogs are nice and all, but what I really need to be doing is writing scripts, and I can't do that right now. The creative lobe of my brain is completely blown out. That's where the blockage is. You mentioned that you were using Final Draft. Have you considered that maybe your software is the problem? I use Scrivener myself. You should try it. Wow, really? Dude, if someone's having a heart attack in front of you, do you take that opportunity to talk about your amazing low-cholesterol diet too? Because that would be awesome. The software is not the problem. The problem is that every time I write, I kill someone. If you're going to try to help, don't suggest a particular brand of sprinkler after the house is already on fire. Grab a hose. Related to this,
I believe everything you say, and I think we should meet so we can discuss this in detail, possibly in my secret basement lair at my mom's house where I live.
Oh, man. That's another reason to remain safely anonymous, isn't it? So, now that the Q&A session is done, does anyone actually have help for me? Please? A.W. Finally! An actual good idea from a comment, which I will now replicate in full. In your last post, you mentioned some movies and books in which the line between the creator and the created had been broken, or at least smudged, in some way. Have you considered that perhaps the people who wrote those movies and books might have had experiences similar to yours? It's possible that they have, and just haven't ever talked about it for the same reason you're trying to stay anonymous, which is, it sounds completely crazy. But if you approached them and your experience is similar to theirs, maybe they would talk to you in confidence. The fact that you actually are a screenwriter of some note might keep them from fleeing in terror, at least at first. The "at least at first" bit is a nice touch, thank you. And I'm glad you have the delusion that a scriptwriter on a weekly basic cable series has any sort of credibility. It warms my heart. But to answer your question, no, it didn't occur to me at all, because, well, it's nuts, isn't it? And we live in the really real world, where stuff like this doesn't happen. But on the other hand, it happened to me, and, no offense to me, I'm not all that special, either as a writer or a human being. So, I have to admit that it's entirely possible that what's happened to me has happened to others. And if it has happened to others, then it's entirely possible they've found some way to deal with it that doesn't involve not writing anymore. And that's the goal here. And now I have a plan. Contact those writers and find out if they've got a secret experience like mine. Which sounds perfectly reasonable until you think about what that actually means. To give you an idea, let me present to you a quick one-act play entitled "Anonywriter Presents His Conundrum to Someone Who Is Not the Internet." Anonywriter: Hello! I have been visited by characters from my scripts who inform me that I kill them whenever I write an action scene. Does this happen to you too? Other writer: Hello, Anonywriter! In one hand, I have a restraining order, and in the other, I have a taser. Which would you like to meet first? Yes, I see no way that this perfect plan could ever go wrong. But, on the other hand, I don't have a better plan, do I? So here's what I'm going to do. Make a list of writers whose characters break the reality wall one way or another. Contact them and find out if it's based on their actual real-world experience without coming across like a psychotic freak bag. Profit! Okay, not profit, but if their work is based on their real-life experiences, find out from them a way to keep writing. Off to craft introductions that don't sound too creepy. Wish me luck, A.W. Guys, seriously now, stop trying to guess what show I work for. I'm just not going to tell you, because I don't want to get fired, which is what happens when people like me talk about their jobs to people like you, i.e. the internet. And especially when people like me are claiming their characters are coming to life and talking to them. I know it's good fun for you to be guessing, but come on, a little charity, please. I promise you that after this is all done, if everything works out, I'll tell you, say in 5 years, or after I win an Emmy, whichever comes first. Bet on 5 years. Okay? Okay. Thank you. Hello, Internet. You're wanting updates. Well, here we go. I've identified some creative types who have written stories similar to my situation, including those we mentioned here earlier. Woody Allen for Purple Rose of Cairo, Jasper Ford, Zach Penn and Adam Leff, Last Action Hero, Zach Helm, Stranger Than Fiction, and Denise Hogan. The plan here is to approach them credits first, to at least suggest I'm not completely insane, and then to ask them, in a very subtle way, about whether what they've written has any connection to their real-life experiences. Then, off they go to the writers, and we'll see if anyone nibbles. And to anticipate some of you raising your hands out there in the audience, yes, I'll share with you the responses after I snip out major identifying details. Oh, don't look at me like that. Remember that anonymity thing I'm striving for? Yeah, too many details and I'm out of my very peculiar little closet. It's a lovely closet. It smells of pine and desperation. But, on the other hand, as you've been helpful, I figure I owe you continuing updates on this thing. Also, to make no mistake about it, I fully expect that the responses will be, "Wow, you're even crazier than most random people who write me. Would you like my suggestion for antipsychotic pharmaceuticals?" Because that's how I would respond to this showing up randomly in my inbox. And it's how I have responded, in fact. You wouldn't believe the sort of random crazy gets sent to you when you're a writer on a successful television series. Or maybe you would. Crazy is highly distributed these days. Insert pause to send off emails, and they're off. Now we get to see how long it takes before anyone responds. Want to start a betting pool? AW. Wow, so that didn't take long at all. The first response, email posted below. XXXXX via gmail.com. Show details, 4:33 p.m., 0 minutes ago. Dear Anana Writer, hello, I'm XXXXX, assistant for XXXXXXX. We received your query and want to know whether it was some sort of creative or interview project you're doing for a major magazine or newspaper. Please let us know. My response, hello, XXXXX. No, it's not for any newspaper or magazine or blog. Well, it might be for my own personal blog. It's more of something I'm asking for my own information. Thank you, and let me know if XXXXXXX has time for a chat. It would be very useful to me. The assistant's response. Unfortunately, XXXXXXX doesn't have any availability at this time. Thanks for your interest, and good luck on your project. Translation. Your crazy would be fine if it was for People magazine, or maybe even Us. But if it's freelance crazy, we don't want anything to do with you. Sigh. There was a time when freelance crazy was respected in this town. I think it was the early 80s. David Lee Roth was hanging out at the Whiskey then, or so I've heard. I was like 6 at the time. One down, 5 to go. AW. New response. This is kind of awesome, actually. 2, Anana Writer, from XXXXXX, Esquire, Partner, XXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXX Mr. Writer. Your email query to XXXXX was forwarded to us by his assistant, as is every letter for which they feel there is some concern about. Mr. XXXXXX values his privacy considerably and was greatly unsettled by your email, both for its content and because it arrived in an unsolicited manner at a private email. At this time, our client has decided not to escalate the matter by asking the XXXXXX Police Department to investigate you and your email. However, we request that you do not ever again attempt to contact our client in any way. If you attempt to do so, we will forward all correspondence both to the XXXXXX Police Department and to the FBI and file for a restraining order against you. I do not need to tell you that such a request would instantly become news, severely impacting your career as a staff writer on XXXXXXXXXXXXX. We trust that this is the last time we will hear from you. Yours, XXXXXXXXXX, Esquire, Partner, XXXXXXXXXXXXX, and XXXXX. Whoa! Just for the record, the email I sent did not begin, "Dear XXXXX, as I happened to be standing over your bed last night, watching you sleep." It really didn't, I swear. Either this person gets more crazy emails than usual from people who dress up as their cat and then stand outside their house, or this person got spooked by this email for an entirely other reason. Is it worth getting the FBI involved to find out? No. No, it is not. Not yet, anyway. Still curious. And now, I'm fighting off